Okay, should probably get started. Right, I'm a bit reluctant to wear this, but it's the only way to keep my recorder on me while I wander around. So, if I collapse into a sweating heap, please forgive me. I'm recording it. I know there are some people who weren't able to make it. Okay, so we've still got about a minute. I should probably wait a minute in case you have to sprinkle, shouldn't I? Okay, does anyone actually read weird fiction? No. Does anyone know what weird fiction is? It's weird, yes? Good start. Anything else? You can have myths in. Anyone recognise that? No, how about, that's Chaugnar Faugun. How about Cthulhu? Cthulhu? Ring any bells? Okay, good, good. Just about familiar. H.P. Lovecraft? August Derleth? Clark Ashton Smith? Okay, those are the kind of people I'm talking about. People that mostly published in Weird Tales magazines in the 1910s to 1940s. That sort of thing. That is the weird fiction genre. So, I know this is mostly completely different people from my last lecture, so I'm just going to quickly go over some of the basics. Nope, using the mouse won't work because that's not my computer. So, what is weird fiction? It's a genre or subgenre of speculative fiction, which includes speculative fiction as things like fantasy, science fiction, horror, these non-realist types of fiction. And it sort of, we would say, coalesced in the 1920s. It came together as an identifiable movement in the 1920s, mostly in America, but not entirely. And it's strongly associated with pulp magazines, so cheap magazines that were published to a wide audience, not just to literary people. Before these different genres, fantasy, mystery, thrillers, horrors, science fiction, before they were all very distinct, it's the way they tend to be now, when it was more anything goes. And there's a small number of authors who are kind of seen as the key figures in its development. And that was kind of what I went through last time. And this is the classic definition of weird fiction. I'm not going to read all through it, but it's this idea of strangeness, of things that you can't understand or explain. This idea of creating a sense of being puzzled or confused, but in an interesting way, or being scared because things aren't operating according to the laws of the universe, according to order, according to what we expect. It's very strongly associated with short stories because it tends to be much more about atmosphere and idea than it is about plot. And also because it tends to de-emphasize things like personal development, which obviously is a key part of most fiction. And so there's not as much room because there's less interest in plot and people. There's this big emphasis on atmosphere and impressions and creating those through styles of writing. And it doesn't explain what's going on. These are all fuzzy boundaries. You can't easily say this one is definitely just weird fiction and not anything else. There's not a clear definition. But they tend not to be straightforward explanations like you might get in science fiction, where it's, the interdimensional energies from the Martian spaceship caused the such and such. No, you don't get that. you don't tend to get rules and patterns of magic as you might in fantasy. This is how these creatures operate. This is what they do. Everyone knows you can get the sword that will do the thing, and this is the prophecy. You don't tend to get that. And you don't... It's distinguished from horror as such because the... Some kinds of weird fiction do blend into horror, but generally fear and horror is not really the goal of most of it. It's kind of intriguing, it's strange, it's escapism. Thinking, oh, this is very strange, what's going on? That pleasant sense of not knowing is what it's trying to do. But some of the authors, for example, H.P. Lovecraft, were very interested in trying to create fear. And variably successful. I went through the time, tomes, and tentacles part last time, and these are some of the influences that led to it, which is what I'll be talking about mostly today. You have the Gothic, so the kind of melodramatic Victorian literature that came towards the end of the 19th century. You've got ghost stories which stretch back much longer and cross cultural boundaries. You had scientific romance, which was a much newer idea. And these are things like H.G. Wells, The Time Machine, War of the Worlds, Jules Verne, people talking about, oh, you could have this fantastic scientific invention. You could go to the moon, you can go to other times, you can go into the heart of the world. And there was also the influence of literature from the East, which, from the point of view of America and Britain, obviously, is the Middle East, to some extent Africa, India, China, Japan. And these were starting to become available to a fairly wide audience through translation. Before that, only very small numbers of people had the language skills or did the travelling to have the exposure to that. But at the turn of the century, 1880 to 1920, a lot of things were becoming available in translation through the increased cultural contact. And that exposed Western authors and Western literary circles to a lot of new ideas that they began to incorporate, new ways of thinking about things. And you also had these other kinds of influences. People who were scientists. H.P. Lovecraft was a fanatical scholar of astronomy. He was really interested in that. You had people who were really interested in physics, medicine, chemistry, who were exploring things through that. You had archaeological discoveries that were changing Western ideas about the age of human civilization, for example. Evolution was becoming accepted by ordinary people and not just by academics. You had folklore, there was the Brothers Grimm and people like that were going around collecting folklore in Europe and in America because people were starting to realise that modernisation was leading to a lot of knowledge, a lot of old stories being lost. And you had anthropology, people were doing serious studies of other cultures, and to be honest, the main way that was influencing stories was people were finding specific interesting things about another culture and borrowing it or turning it into the basis of a story. So these days we might not consider it was a very respectful way to deal with that, but sometimes it was much more harmless. So let's see. And these are some of the main authors. You've got H.P. Lovecraft. Atmosphere and weird horror and writing about academics and scholars. Robert E. Howard, who wrote the Conan books, if anyone is familiar with Conan, played by Arnold Schwarzenegger. And he, very different style, heroic adventures but full of weirdness. He had these big themes about barbarism versus civilization and how barbarism was fundamentally better. Civilization would inevitably become corrupt and weak and collapse. And he wrote to try and create energy, the sort of energy that would keep people reading without pausing to breathe. And you had Clark Ashton Smith, very different. he wrote just strange things that happened. There would be a story to it, but often it's, oh, this thing happened to these people. He often does a style what we call picaresque, so the characters are often not heroes. Quite often they're explicitly not heroes. They're untrustworthy people. A lot of his characters are untrustworthy, unreliable. His best known character is the great wizard Ibon, who is never seen to do any magic and mostly spends his time tricking people. He wrote in what's called the Dying Earth genre, amongst others. So lots of stories about the distant future, millions of years away, when most of human civilization has collapsed, when magic has become widespread, when the sun is old and red, and the landscape is tired and full of strange magic. And he was fundamentally just trying to write stories that people would be entertained by. So that's the three big names that were in these magazines, and they're very different approaches to what they were doing. But they were all friends, they corresponded, they exchanged ideas, and there was what was called the Lovecraft Circle, which was them and many other writers who would exchange ideas. They would read and comment on each other's story drafts, and they would even take ideas and write their own story that was the version of the same idea, this kind of thing. And part of that was this borrowing and sharing of their creations helps to create this particular genre, created a sense of depth to the genre, because ideas you read in one author's story might crop up somewhere else. I forgot to mention at the start, if you've got any questions or any comments, you want to say something while I'm talking, please just put your hand up and let me know. This is not very formal. Okay. And just very briefly, the immediate influences. So just before weird fiction was becoming a big deal, we had a small number of major authors. The big one was Edgar Allan Poe. All of the major authors wrote about their influence from Edgar Allan Poe. And actually, his influence was huge. It stretched from people like H.P. Lovecraft through to Itagawa Rampo, a Japanese author who borrowed Poe's name for his pen name. And his innovation was trying to write atmospheric stories, without the traditional religious moral elements that real Gothic literature tended to have, without the melodrama, and trying to make it more realistic in terms of why people felt certain ways, using psychology, which he was very keen on, to understand behaviour and write about human behaviour in a more convincing way, and use that to create, this is an atmosphere of lightheartedness, but this bit is an atmosphere of confusion or terror or whatever else, and trying to create that sense of reality, even though there were strange things happening in these stories, mysteries and supernatural events. We had Robert W. Chambers, who was mostly known as a romance author, sometimes a poet, and he wrote in a very, very poetic literary style. And he introduced this idea of another strand of weird fiction, which is corruption and decadence as a source of weirdness, and the power of art to change people's behaviour and make people do things that are or that seem mad to people who aren't artists, who aren't caught up in that world. Most famously, The King in Yellow was his big invention, this book that was supposed to be... at the time, there were a lot of ideas, particularly things like the work of Oscar Wilde and some other authors, that was thought to be so decadent and so shocking that the general public, normal people, shouldn't be allowed to read it, because it would corrupt them, would corrupt their morals and damage society. And I think probably all societies have encountered this kind of period of literature. And Chambers was playing on this idea, so he created this idea of a play called The King in Yellow, which would literally drive people mad if they performed it or saw it. And it had a sort of... You know how there can be an underworld sometimes in cultures with like the place where the dead go, the place where ghosts go? In the West, we have things like fairy, which is the place where elves and fairies and these kinds of people are supposed to live. And there's things like parallel dimensions in science fiction. That Chambers created a sort of parallel world that existed in art. You got to it by becoming sufficiently mad that you were there. It's quite a strange idea. You have to have really read it to understand. But this was this big innovation, that state of mind and outlook could be almost seen as a place and as a society. You had people like Arthur Machen, who was writing stories based very heavily on folklore. He was a big fan of traditional British folklore. Lord Dunsany, who was inventing his own gods, his own worlds, to write whimsical mythology, sometimes funny, sometimes tragic, sometimes heroic. And you were getting unfamiliar, these Eastern elements that were, for example, being translated by Koizumi Yakumo. I can't remember the Chinese version of his name. Lafcadio Hearn. But he translated things like Kwaidan, a set of ghost stories from Japan, many other famous things. He does have I don't know the Hans of his name, I'm sorry. I should have put that in. You will know who it is, I just can't remember off the top of my head. And then you had people who were contemporaries, but they were writing at the same time but weren't involved in weird fiction, like M.R. James, who was a big writer of ghost stories, but they were not the traditional ghost story. You didn't get the spirit of a child who was murdered or an old man who had a secret to tell you appearing. His ghosts are usually not really recognisably human. It's often not clear what they are, what they came from, why they exist. Morality is not usually a feature of his stories, which in the Western ghost story tradition is very strange. As far as I understand it, in more Asian kind of ghost stories, there's more of an idea that ghosts just happen to people. That it's not necessarily about your own moral decisions that cause you to be haunted, which is the Western idea. You know, you are haunted by the ghost of the person you murdered or you betrayed. But I believe, please do correct me if I'm wrong, that in more Eastern ghost stories, that's less of a focus, and there are more just kind of ghosts there, and you may run across them. Maybe. That's not a really essential point. The point is that this was a new idea, that you'd have ghost stories where you weren't encountering a ghost because you'd done something wrong. You were encountering a ghost because you were unlucky, basically. You went to the place where there was the ghost. You touched the thing that was associated with the ghost. That's all. For example, there's a famous story called "A Whistle and I'll Come to You, My Lad." And it's about a scholar who is looking at some old ruined buildings and he finds a medieval or an ancient metal whistle, a kind of flute, and tries it out. And as a result, he starts to be haunted by this terrifying, inhuman ghost that borrows the shape of objects around him in ways that the way, as James describes them, can become strangely alarming. Even though, if you think about it, a bedsheet isn't scary. But the way it's being described is what's trying to create that atmosphere. And he was an antiquarian, so a scholar of old things, particularly churches and church history. And he drew really heavily on that to try and create, the same as Poe, but a different angle, this idea of trying to create supernatural stories with a very realistic feel, so the supernatural parts were emphasised, rather than the whole story being fantastical. And it was to try and bring it closer to ordinary people and make them feel more like they could believe in it, like it could happen to them. It felt closer. And at least one of his stories was sufficiently realistic that people in the area now treat it as just being actual folklore. And they will tell this traditional folk tale to tourists and visitors, even though it was specifically written by this guy. It's convincing enough in its details and writing that local people don't really generally think of it as being a story that was written. They just think of it as being part of their folklore.
He's kind of creating a world so real. Very much, you know, it's so different from H.P. Lovecraft, because he's trying to create a totally different one.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, so Lovecraft's very much inventing his own cities that things happen in. Arkham, Innsmouth, Dunwich, these kinds of places.
Very much like from a different dimension.
Yeah, yeah, and most of the strange things that happen are about these alien influences from outside, from somewhere outside space or time. Whereas M.R. James, yes, very, very different. Very, very heavily rooted in history, archaeology, ancient traditions, and that kind of thing, and very specific actual places as well. And that's partly why this kind of thing happens. Mm-hmm. So this story is set in a very specific part of Britain and draws on real folklore to make the story convincing.
But, you know, the ghost, as you just mentioned, the ghost, it takes the form of something, you know. He's very I forgot the name you mentioned, the one who found the whistle, the wooden whistle.
Yeah.
He took the form of something he was so familiar with.
Yeah.
Right, so that's so different from Cthulhu.
Absolutely, yeah. Huge tentacles and yeah.
Okay.
So it's quite a broad set of ideas and influences that people are drawing on. Although I do slightly wonder if the M.R. James things are partly influenced by the idea of kind of objects as being haunted, which I don't know Chinese ghost stories well enough, I know is a thing in Japanese folklore. And that was being translated at that time, so I do wonder if he'd sort of got that idea subconsciously about using objects as the focus of a ghost story instead of people. But we have William Hope Hodgson. So again, he was Victorian era, and he was writing these long, detailed stories where he'd sort of scatter details through it, which eventually build up to, for you to go, wait a minute. For example, House on the Borderlands, which is his big famous one, his novel. Once you get to the end of the story, you start to think, hang on, maybe the narrator is just insane. Because throughout it, you're hearing the narrator's own description of what's happening. And then you start to look back and go, based on the way other people have been behaving, maybe it's just that he's insane. So there's these kinds of things. And he is one of the earliest known stories that's specifically about what's called cosmic horror. This idea of incredible emotion associated with understanding and perceiving the scale of the universe. So he has characters suddenly being hurled out into the universe, seeing the whole universe, travelling incredible amounts of time, and feeling their own insignificance, or feeling just how big and amazing the universe is. He uses ideas like isolation insanity and visions and dreams, which become big themes in weird fiction. H.P. Lovecraft uses dreams a lot. A lot of the authors use possible madness, unreliable narrators, as big aspects of their stories, and part of making it that sense of uncertainty is because you can't tell how much of what you're seeing is actually what's happening. And he has this idea of there being things in the stories that are not just, oh, this is an ancient god, this is a fairy, the ghost, this is an alien. And I mean, aliens were appearing at this time in stories, but you could have things that were both, or were some strange combination of the two. So again, in House on the Borderland, our protagonist is hurled into space, right across the universe, and finds himself on this strange planet, surrounded by mountain-sized heads that seem to be sort of strange spiritual creatures watching over something, but that also seem to reflect all of the known gods and spirits and heroes of Earth legends, of Earth mythology and religion. So this idea of being, are these creatures actually, they seem to be something from another part of the universe, from another world, but they also seem to also be in some way the gods of Earth, and that very strange relationship going on there. So starting to mix these ideas of science and religion and mythology together and break down some of those boundaries. And he very much avoids explaining anything that's happening. You draw your own conclusions. Why is this person having visions? Why does the house apparently travel through time and lead his dog to melt away into a pile of bones, but the people are unharmed? What is the strange creature with the head of a pig stalking around the house? Is it real? All of these things, you just don't know. And I thought I had an audio version of this, but maybe not. But this is an extract from The House on the Borderland, which is the big one. Slowly I traced the shadowy outline of one of the things. And these are strange creatures that seem to have emerged from a quarry, a place where they dig stone, near his house. It appeared to be holding on to the bars of the window, and its attitude, its position, suggested climbing. I went nearer to the window and held the light higher. There was no need to be afraid of the creature. The bars were strong, and there was little danger of its being able to move them. And then suddenly, in spite of the knowledge that the brute could not reach to harm me, I had a return of the horrible sensation of fear that had assailed me on that night a week previously. It was that same feeling of helpless, shuddering fright. I realized dimly that the creature's eyes were looking into mine with a steady, compelling stare. I tried to turn away, but could not. I seemed now to see the window through a mist. Then I thought other eyes came and peered, and yet others, until a whole galaxy of malignant, staring orbs seemed to hold me in thrall. And this is the kind of thing that happens in his books. Again, because his things tend to be spread out so much, I couldn't really find one piece to pull out that goes, this is his writing style. It's all about doing things over time. But that's a sense of the kind of things that he writes about. So, on to the sort of main focus, I hope, of this lecture. Any questions so far? No? Okay. So, the really older things. This is a quote from a thesis by a scholar called Sarah Dodd. The collection is a monstrous hybrid made out of fragments of folklore, myth, previous stories and pure invention, using different literary traditions. And that's from a thesis about Yao Zhai Zhiyi. But it is actually fairly applicable to the weird tales genre, and there's actually a surprising amount of crossover between them. The way that they are borrowing anything that seems to fit what they want to do and using it without worrying about what kind of thing is it, what kind of story is it, what kind of literature is it. So, the main kind of somewhat strange literature that would lead into weird fiction is Gothic. And Gothic literature is all about melodrama, very exaggerated dramatic events is what we would say. It tends to have big focus on morality. This person or this person's ancestors committed a terrible sin and they are all accursed, this kind of thing. Unto the seventh generation they shall all be stricken with madness. You get the idea. And there'll be ghosts and strange patches of blood appearing on things and floating daggers and hidden passages and people sneaking around in the darkness and big descriptions of great looming portals into the house, strewn with cobwebs and darkness and bones and all this kind of thing. And there's lots about human evil, the bad things that people do to other people. Emotions, really strong, powerful emotions. And yes, ghosts. And it can be very entertaining, but it's very much not realistic. And if you're ever... Has anyone read Wuthering Heights? Okay, if you stop and think for about 30 seconds about what's happening in Wuthering Heights, you'll probably think, wait a minute, nothing about the way any of these people behave is at all plausible. They don't behave like people. They don't react to situations like people. Most of their problems could be solved quite easily by being reasonable. But that's not what that kind of literature is about. It's about fate and the way people's lives are tied into each other and the great tragedies and great things that people do. There were some authors starting to incorporate some slightly stranger elements, things like unreliability, things like getting rid of these Christian moral frameworks that were around the stories and just focusing on the story itself without that kind of teaching element which had previously been there. This idea that reading a story should teach you something about how to behave. They were starting to get rid of that idea. But what they had got and what they really contributed was this idea of the importance of atmosphere, of really conveying what a place is like, you can imagine it, how it feels, how it looks, the character. And in Gothic literature, and to some extent in weird fiction, you'll come across this idea that places are characters. And sometimes the places have more personality than the characters do. Things like Gormenghast is a famous one for this. It's about this huge castle and the people that live in it, but really the castle is the protagonist and everyone else is just someone that lives there. It's obviously it's not always the case, but that was a big thing. You tend to have generations of people living in the same families. You have people returning to their ancestral home and discovering the terrible deeds of their ancestors. Or you have a village where these dreadful things are happening. And this is the kind of thing that's going on. And things like Dracula is one of the that's sort of considered one of the slightly more experimental, these more mature, slightly later, slightly subversive gothic novels. It moves around more. It's incorporating these explicitly supernatural things, but it is definitely part of the gothic tradition. And similarly, you will see, once we get onto weird fiction, that people like H.P. Lovecraft are creating these towns and very, very heavily trying to evoke a specific atmosphere, often based on a real place, to make you feel a particular way about it. What is supposed to be here? Ah, yes. So this is... I don't think I can change which bits we're seeing, which is not helpful. This is one of Edgar Allan Poe's famous stories, The Fall of the House of Usher. This is the House of Usher. And the family is also the House of Usher. That's just a way of naming. But you can see there that conflation, that the way of thinking of the house, the place, as really the focus of the story. And this story, again, because Poe is developing from the Gothic tradition, Poe is exploring this idea that the people who live there are, in some ways, their souls are part of this house, and their fate is completely tied into the fate of the house. And if nobody minds spoilers, okay, they're all doomed. And they're all doomed together. If I could control where in this video we were, I would, but I'm not sure I can. So, can I do that? Can I do anything like that? No. Okay, I mean, you're getting the idea. It's all going through shadowy woods, looking at houses in the dark and the storm, this kind of thing. That's very much what we're dealing with here. So, you've got some very notable influences. Wuthering Heights, as I said, was quite a big one. And that's not completely a traditional Gothic, although it does have this really strong sense of place. The power of these moors that are full of some kind of supernatural something. Then the way they're described, it's always as though there's something not natural about them. There's some kind of fate and sinister energy in them. And these houses that are somehow full of emotion, and where people's thoughts and feelings reflect the house, and the house reflects people. There's a strong implication at several parts of the story that Heathcliff, the sort of focus of the story, you could say, one of the two foci of the story, may not actually be human at all. He is described several times as demonic, as ghoulish, as having some kind of non-human origin, and his origins are mysterious. It's not quite clear who he is or where he comes from. There are these ideas of there being these fundamental connections between people's minds and people's souls, particularly between Heathcliff and Kathy, who are the doomed romantic couple. And there are some hints of reincarnation and our ancestral memory of thoughts and personality being passed down through families. And all those are elements that make that strange, and again, that will influence the writers that are reading them, but who will decide to take those ideas in different directions. You've got Frankenstein, very early science fiction work. It's now considered, but she didn't really consider it to be science fiction. That wasn't a thing then. She's blending scientific and spiritual and emotional issues, and it really explores ideas that, again, were becoming important with developments like the theory of evolution becoming widespread, of people questioning religious aspects of culture, of what is family, what are family responsibilities, what responsibilities do we have to other people, what is human, who is human, what does that mean, and what is right for people to do in extreme circumstances, as we will see the Frankenstein's monster does some terrible things, but the treatment of them in the story questions which of these things are terrible, how do they compare to the things being done to the monster, and this kind of thing. I'm just going to look at Wuthering Heights briefly. Some of the things it does, one of the big things is it's doing a similar thing to what M.R. James is doing. It's taking this Victorian realism, this big, straightforward literature that is becoming popular, and integrating it with ghost stories. So it's taking, here is a story about what happens to a family, which is a very popular genre, and saying, yes, but what if we had ghosts? Also ghosts. But she's not having the ghosts as there are people, but also ghosts, they're a separate thing. She's using the descriptions and the way the story is structured with these places to make the supernatural things become a logical part of the landscape. These moorlands, these wild places where they live, are described in such a strange and alien way. It's everything about it is strange and unearthly, that it seems natural that things that may or may not be ghosts are happening, that strange weather happens. Was that a strange gust of wind at the window, or was it someone tapping? These kinds of things, and trying to create a situation where you might quite naturally, your mind might move between those thoughts. Did I hear fingers scraping? Or was it just some leaves? These kinds of things. And that's what she's trying to do. And there's this big supernatural element in the romantic relationship. And again, she's pushing that boundary from the thing where people seem to really understand each other's feelings and hearts to an extent where it seems unnatural, uncanny. They know too much about each other. Their connection is too strong. Their emotional connection is impossibly strong. And they are so closely associated that they become ghosts. They haunt each other after their deaths. And we have this idea of a narrator who doesn't present explanations. Well, it turned out that what was happening was this and this. No, there's none of that. Who doesn't present a moral explanation for things, or what we can learn from this. As you might, for example, if you think about Romeo and Juliet, which has some similar ideas, the play itself has messages at the end about the importance of not letting feuds between families destroy generation after generation, of paying attention to family members. What are they doing? What do they need? What do they want? Of trying to be reconciled. But that's not part of Wuthering Heights. It's simply telling you what's happened, just presenting these strange events for you. I think this might be a good time for a break. It's been about 45 minutes, and I don't want to just keep talking endlessly while everyone falls asleep. So let's have a quick break. Hey, yeah, any thoughts, any questions about anything? Okay, if you think of anything, let me know.
They put a lot of morals in the stories.
Yeah.
You're supposed to learn things from them. But that kind of stuff, as you just mentioned about Frankenstein or the vampire,
Dracula, yeah.
Dracula, the vampire scene. He kind of, I think his author, they might also be in a kind of conflict with the reality and their own thoughts. They try to figure out what maybe writing is a process for them to explore more about themselves.
Yeah.
You know, these writers and their own families, and the families, I mean, they've grown up with, and also the families they're... anyway, I think that has a great impact on that part.
Yeah, yeah. I think you're right. I mean, so Mary Shelley, for example, was very unconventional in various ways.
Yeah.
My favourite one is still that she kept her husband's fossilised heart in her desk. Yeah, the ultimate goth. You know, so she was interested in playing around with these ideas of... She wanted to create stories, but she was also interested in playing around with these ideas of, you know, what is morality? Which bits of the things we've been taught by our culture, by our parents, are important?
That's also, as you said, the Victorian age. Kind of people begin to question.
Yeah. You've had all these very conventional ideas, this very strict kind of culture. And I mean, it goes through phases, I think, in terms of culture, of how strict and how conventional things are. Conformist, maybe. And then you have these cycles of people going, you know, why is this? Is this true? What if this is something different?
So it's sad, because of the strict kind of moral things during the Victorian age, and people need to find something, find a way. And does that might explain why there is a kind of search of those weird stories?
I think it might. There's a lot of things that people are wanting to explore around that time, and it's... I think partly it's an indirect way of exploring them. Like, so for example, at a much earlier point, people would have art commissioned. And this is a Western thing. They would have art, but most art was very restricted in terms of what was acceptable. You know, you couldn't have anything that was seen as, I won't say risque, but I don't know if you know that word. Like, it might be seen as immoral. But if you had a painting of a scene from classical literature, that was fine.
Okay.
So all these wealthy people would have, for example, pictures of beautiful nude women.
Uh-huh.
But it's okay because it's a scene from this classical story.
It's art.
Exactly. Okay. It's art. And I think some parts of, for example, Victorian literature, they were using some of these very dramatic kinds of stories or some metaphors to explore ideas like sexuality.
Yeah.
So I know Dracula has been quite often seen as partly...
That's about kind of, yes,
yeah, sort of one of these ideas. Mm-hmm. And also about foreignness. Mm-hmm. It's part of it. Because, of course, Dracula is a foreigner coming in. And I think, to an extent, there was partly some about conventional women's feelings of attraction towards men from other cultures who weren't coming, you know, who weren't part of the same very strict culture, and the opportunities that they felt they saw in these, you know, oh, you've been exposed to these new ideas of how you can be, and that was seen as attractive, but then to British men it was dangerous because they're stealing our women, basically, which is like the eternal cry, they're stealing our women.
I've never thought about that one before. I read that, you know, I saw a movie about Dracula, but I've never read that book. You know, before I read that book, I just kind of think it's just a book for entertainment. Okay, but then when you read more about it, when you try to dig more or behind the stories and the background information, you say, no, it's not just about ghost for fun. It's more about people, who they are, and also your inner monster.
Yeah, you know, and people's capacity to be good or evil or conventional or unconventional. And I mean, things like the way Lucy's character changes uh-huh. as she is becoming a vampire. Yeah. Uh-huh. But that's a lot of that you can see as being her losing the feelings of constraint of Victorian society and becoming much more like a modern person, as far, you know, to our eyes. Unconventional and more relaxed about things. And but it was shocking at the time, yeah. you know, because she's breaking free of those things.
Sometimes it's really alarming or scary to think about. It's okay.
I just realised it's still on. So,
no, no, it's okay.
Yeah. It's just because when I was standing there, the radiators are on, so it's so hot.
It's okay. I got my jacket.
Mm, cool.
Okay.
Are you going to start? Yeah, I should go back. I should restart. So, that is Wuthering Heights. Just check. We're okay. So, and these are some of those quotes about Heathcliff that suggest he may not be entirely human. Those deep black eyes, that smile and ghastly paleness. It appeared not Mr. Heathcliff, but a goblin. And nowadays you might think of a goblin as being a small green person from Lord of the Rings. But at that time, it didn't have that meaning yet. It was just anything uncanny, anything strange. It's more like grey. Just a very general kind of word. You get people saying things like, is he a ghoul or a vampire? I'd read of such hideous incarnate demons. Incarnate means in the shape of people. He is like a man's shape animated by demon life. A ghoul. And Ifrit. And one of the things that's interesting about these is that Ghul and Ifrit are both words taken directly from Arabic. And they are coming almost certainly from 1001 Nights, the tale of the Arabian Nights, which has already been translated into English and has become extremely popular. Don't know why this is in the wrong order. We've got some older things. Going back, we're leaping back now. Because before the Victorian period, literature starts to become much more religiously focused. Much more focused on telling you what they call improving moral tales. So 16th, 17th, 18th century literature has a lot less in terms of wondrous kind of stories. But if we go all the way back to the classics, which were available in this time, Greek and Roman literature, they are full of gods and spirits and strange things. There are werewolves, there are people encountering showers of knives, there are in Phlegon's Book of Marvels, which is this collection of what we would call paranormal short stories, basically, paranormal events, there are all these things about ghosts and strange creatures and strange places, people having visions, and there is what may be the earlier, or certainly the earliest Western corpse bride story. In Philemon and I want to say Machates, is it Machates? Yes, Philemon and Machates, which is this. So this soldier called Machates is staying at a house. He's a guest there, and he starts to meet this beautiful girl, and she starts to come and visit him at night. And she wants to keep it quiet. But eventually he starts to hear more about it, and he starts to hear this name, and he realizes that a girl answering her description died recently. And he's starting to wonder, can this really be true? Is he in love with a ghost? And as she ate and drank with him, he simply could not believe what the others had told him. And he supposed that some grave robbers had dug into the tomb and then sold the clothes and gold of the dead girl, is the idea, to this girl's father. That's the explanation he's coming up with to explain how can this be happening, she's so real. But no, it's the daughter of this house. She has returned and she is in love with him, but through the interference of the family, unfortunately, they are not meant to be together. You've got Scandinavian literature, the Norse literature. I don't know how familiar people here are with Norse literature. We learn about it as part of it because it's relevant to our culture, but I don't imagine it's a big part of your education. But if you enjoy Marvel films, you'll have encountered some of those people. Thor, Odin, Freya, Loki, all these people. And one of the things that's interesting about Scandinavian mythology compared to most Western mythology is that it is not good versus evil. Christianity, Judaism, Islam are all good versus evil. But in the Norse mythology, it's only chaos and order. Order is created and is a short-term thing. The gods, the heavens, the civilizations that people build. And chaos is all around, just waiting for those things to collapse. You can only win temporary victories against chaos. In the end, Ragnarok will come, the twilight of the gods. Fimbulwinter, the ultimate winter, will completely overwhelm the world and freeze everyone. A huge wolf, Fenrir, will eat the sun. The serpent, that is the snake that wraps around the world, will break free and devour the father of the gods. And almost everything will be destroyed. And it presents this idea that heroism really is just doing what you can for now. Even if ultimately you will lose, it doesn't matter. It's about facing your fate cheerfully and with honour. And this is a really strong idea in kind of Viking styles of fiction. And these things become strong, important themes in weird fiction. There is a big sense that whatever humanity has created is temporary and small compared to the universe. And ultimately, the strangeness beyond will triumph. And there's also this idea that the protagonists and the heroes of these stories are not usually saving the world. They are achieving something small, temporary and local, but it's still heroic. Or they are falling under the weight of this infinite chaos. So you do have people going mad. You have people unable to live with the terrible things they've seen or the secrets they know. But you also get people finding ways to protect the world, to get rid of the secrets that nobody should know, to lock away the terrible creatures or gods that are threatening to destroy the world. But it's always temporary. And this is a description from Norse mythology, which gives you some idea. Unfortunately, I couldn't find a recording. Before the beginning, there was nothing. No earth, no heavens, no stars, no sky. Only the mist world, formless and shapeless. And the fire world, always burning. To the north was Niflheim, the dark world. Here 11 poisonous rivers cut through the mist, each springing from the same well, the centre of it all, the roaring maelstrom called Fergelmir. Niflheim was colder than cold, and the murky mist that cloaked everything hung heavily. The skies were hidden by mist, and the ground was clouded by the chilly fog. To the south was Muspel. Muspel was fire. Everything there glowed and burned. Muspel was light where Niflheim was grey, molten lava where the mist world was frozen. The land was aflame with the roaring heat of a blacksmith's fire. There was no solid earth, no sky, nothing but sparks and spurting heat, molten rocks and burning embers. In Muspel, at the edge of the flame where the mist burns into light, where the land ends, stood Surtr, who existed before the gods. He stands there now. He holds a flaming sword, and the bubbling lava and the freezing mist are as one to him. It is said that at Ragnarok, which is the end of the world, and only then Surtr will leave his station. He will go forth from Muspel with his flaming sword and burn the world with fire, and one by one the gods will fall before him. Between Muspel and Niflheim was a void, an empty place of nothingness, without form. The rivers of the mist world flowed into the void, which was called Ginnungagap, the yawning gap. And that is pretty much the kind of thing that the Norse thought was going on. And that's more or less what they expect the world to return to after Ragnarok, when the gods are destroyed by Surtr. There's a nice picture for you. Ragnarok. That will be Surtr. I believe... can't remember who that is, I should know. But you can see here are armies of the dead returning to destroy living creatures, and fire and birds, carrion, crows in the sky waiting to feast on the dead, and all these terrible things, huge monsters, the Jotun, ice trolls. Let's move on from a very cold place in the north to a warm place further south. The 1001 Nights. In the 18th century, these became available in French, which educated people could usually read in most parts of Europe. So it became known to the upper classes, the literate people. And it was wildly popular. Partly, they were new. Novels were still relatively rare, so this was a new, interesting opportunity. They were weird. They mix all kinds of different elements. They're adventurous, they're heroic, and they have an unexpected kind of humour, which is culturally different to what the Western audiences were used to. So it was exciting. And they blend ordinary things, adventure, science, the supernatural, religion, all these things together freely. Several of the weird fiction authors had a strong love for them. Particularly H.P. Lovecraft is famous for it. Oh, there we go. And this was a big influence that encouraged other authors to think, oh yeah, I can just do that. I don't have to write a religious story or an adventure story. I can write a story in which a wizard rides a flying horse made of clockwork into the sun to fight an alien. H.P. Lovecraft loved them so much, he created a pseudonym, this other person, Abdul Al-Hazred. And he would sign things as being from Al-Hazred. And possibly the most famous fictional book, certainly in Western literature at least, is the Necronomicon, which is supposed to be an Arabic collection of occult, so unknown secrets. So all kinds of things about magic and strange creatures. And this is quite likely inspired by the fact that this was actually happening, that Arabic texts, old and new, were beginning to appear in the West, not just for very, very rare scholars, but they were starting to appear and enter Western culture. And they were full of these exotic stories, things that Westerners weren't used to, the history of the Middle East, history of India, these kinds of things, of legends and mythology that they weren't familiar with, of medical knowledge they weren't familiar with, of scientific ideas. And that sort of thing may be where Lovecraft was inspired. And there's also the fact, of course, some of these things that were being brought in were considered unsuitable. They had too much sexuality. They had the wrong kind of religion. They had people doing magic that might be bad. So all these ideas. And if you read the Arabian Nights, they do skip happily around from people praising Allah to making things out of clockwork, to casting spells, to travelling to distant lands that exist underwater, all kinds of things. You have, in this one, the Enchanted Horse. There's a sultan, a powerful leader, who loved science and geometry, and he gets all kinds of scholars to come to him and bring him new, interesting things. Versed in a knowledge of occult again, very popular word, truths and subtleties. And all of these sages bring him basically clockwork or mechanical toys, but they all have basically magical powers, we would say now. But they're not described as magical, they're described as being machines. So this Persian has a mechanical horse that can fly, and that will be a big part of the story. But elsewhere, sometimes in the same stories, they're about genie, which are supernatural creatures. They're about wizards, enchanters, people having heroic adventures, fighting monsters. Or they might be about thieves, like in Ali Baba, or talking animals, or people having terrible experiences but surviving because they pray sincerely to Allah. There's this whole blend of things, all these different cultural elements, and almost interchangeable sometimes. So, you know, a noble prince might impress and overawe people when he visits by mentioning who he is, and his political power and his social power impresses everyone. And in exactly the same way, a wizard might demonstrate powerful magic, or a genie might appear and people fall to the ground in fear because of its supernatural power. And those are almost interchangeable in some ways. That is the Enchanted Horse, one of the many covers from it. And you can see in this one it just looks like a horse. It doesn't, I think they've forgotten that it's supposed to be made out of wood and brass, but still. Any questions? No? Okay. Okay, this is the dangerous part of the lecture. Okay, please tell me when I get things wrong. I can't not talk about this, but I'm also very conscious that you're all Chinese. So, yes, these are things. This is for in case there are any Western people in the audience, which there aren't. So, these tend to have relatively archaic styles of writing. They're intended for literate people to enjoy and appreciate them, full of allusions to other literature and these kinds of things. But there is this tradition of recording unusual events, which is parallel to the Greek and Roman traditions of doing the same thing, which were lost when Western civilization collapsed. But these were not morality stories usually, unlike a lot of the Western ones. There is some kind of overlap between some of these things. In Greek legends, you have creatures called Lamia who will prey on men. They will make friends with men and then secretly drink their blood or devour their hearts. And that can be seen, some of the stories are quite similar to things like Nie Xia Qian. And these kinds of parallels made it easier for Western authors to understand them and to think about how to mix in some of these ideas. how they could be brought into their own writing to expand what they could do. By the early Qing dynasties, the collections of Chuan Shi and Zhi were being reprinted. There were more collections coming out. There was getting to be a lot of stuff that was the same. And so the author, Judith Seitlin, suggests that they were losing their sense of novelty. They were starting to seem stereotyped. The topics they were talking about, the literary style, everything was starting to seem like it had been done before. And so writers like Pu Songling wanted to renew this idea of what was strange. What was a strange story? Why was it interesting? Why is it relevant? Which is very similar to what the weird fiction authors in the 1920s were doing. They were looking at Gothic fiction and these kinds of things and going, this has all been done. This is not new. It doesn't affect people the way it used to. It's not interesting anymore. We need to find new ways of doing these things. The first English translations of Ya Zhai Zhiyi specifically appeared in 1880 and 1913, and I don't think that's a coincidence. That is the same period when we were getting this transition of Western literature, and when it was mutating into weird stories, and they were starting to display some of these elements from different forms of literature. And they were starting to reach out past the ideas they were used to. Editors were providing prologues or introductions, that's the word, to these collections. I don't know the terms on these, but Gao Heng and Tang Meng Lai were providing prefaces to these stories when they were being published, trying to redefine the interest in the strange, which people had always had, in terms that were morally and intellectually acceptable to people, arguing, justifying the existence of these kinds of writings, using ideas from the Confucian classics, for example, to try and push the literary boundaries so that they could leave room for this non-literary tradition of strange things happening, and try and find ways for them to be more acceptable. And saying things like, the beginnings and endings of the Tao are in danger of being obscured to the world. If curiosity is suppressed, ignorance grows. What we see becomes less and less, and what amazes us becomes more and more. So this idea that if people refuse to consider things that are strange, if people don't listen to and pay attention to strange things that are happening, then they will become more ignorant, more easily surprised, more easily impressed, more easily fooled. Is broadly seems to be the idea. And people will lose their kind of mental, intellectual sophistication. This idea of accepting discussion of things that aren't part of empirical experience, even if they're not true, it doesn't matter. Thinking about them is the important thing, sort of mental exercise. And this is a sort of issue that literature across the world has had to face, all forms of fantastical literature, of being considered pointless, intellectually bad for you, or immoral even. So here is now. That's not going to play because I'm not plugged into anything. I've just realised.
Now genuinely aroused, he clambered into the courtyard through a hole in the wall, only to find that the inner door was also closed. Creeping stealthily up to a window, he peeped through and saw the most hideous sight. A green-faced monster, a ghoul with great jagged teeth like a saw, leaning over a human pelt, the skin of an entire human body spread on the bed, on his bed. The monster had a paintbrush in its hand and was in the process of touching up the skin in lifelike color. When the painting was done, it threw down the brush, lifted up the skin, shook it out like a cloak, and wrapped itself in it. Whereupon it was instantly transformed into his pretty young fugitive friend. When he
And I've just realised that the text and the audio version are different. Well done, but you get the idea. I'm sure you're all familiar with that one. We've still got time. Good. Any questions about those aspects?
Yes.
Okay, the folklores. And, well, I don't know anything about the Scandinavia part, okay? But I was just thinking about the Lord of the Rings. Mm-hmm. Do you think it might have borrowed some ideology from the Scandinavia?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So Tolkien was specifically setting out to write an English mythology because there wasn't really one. And he was his interests were very strong in things like Norse literature. So he specifically based it on things like the sagas of Norse literature. He borrowed names in some cases, and a lot of the things are inspired, a lot of the elements of the stories are inspired by things from the Norse literature. So yeah, I think there's a lot of parallels.
Because you said about the chaos and order. The order will just win for, you know, just a short period of time. People know that. But people still willing to die for that, okay, to fight for that, okay. So I think that's very much like, you know, the heroes, like the genies, the little, what is that?
Hobbits,
yes, okay, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because Lord of the Rings is specifically trying to do good and evil. But I think you can also, particularly if you looked at it from things like the Hobbit's point of view, the place they come from is order.
Yeah.
It's mm-hmm. like a really modern, suburban kind of order. Mm-hmm. There's very peaceful, regular lifestyles. And then all of the evil is very closely tied up with chaos. It's bringing change and destruction of tradition. And yeah, I think there is a very similar thing going on there. I haven't had time to read it, but I do have something about the sort of cosmic danger in Scandinavian literature and Tolkien. So I'll remind me and I'll send you a link to it.
Okay.
Anything else? No? Okay. So I can move on a bit to this. This is coming back to Sarah Dodd again. The author, Jeffrey Cohen, has argued that monsters in literature are what he calls a cultural body. And they're basically the things that a culture worries about or wants or is scared of, turned into a more kind of physical form so that stories can be told about it. So here's a quote. In order to domesticate and tame or disempower, so take power away from, what a culture finds threatening, the monster is created. And this making of monsters gives insight into what cultures fear. So we could say, for example, let's go back to the Norse. They have the ice giants, who are, all of their names are different kinds of ice, frost, winter, these things. Because they lived in the north, it was very cold, and they were in constant danger of having their crops destroyed or their homes destroyed by bad weather. So those were a serious concern. So we could argue that the frost giants represent that cultural fear of destruction by winter and by cold. and similarly that they were trying to create order in this very difficult part of the world, and they were in constant danger from nature. Or we can look at Dracula, and as we discussed a little bit before, we can say to an extent Dracula represents things that scared Victorians. Foreigners is one. Changes so that people were less bound by cultural expectations, particularly women. And in particular, it's often seen as representing the fear of sexuality, the fear of acknowledging that women might be interested in sex, or that sex might happen at all. It's also been seen as a fear of the upper classes, of people coming in from outside and disrupting their established traditional power. Because Dracula is a strange foreigner who appears from nowhere and is suddenly a powerful part of the social scene and appears to be working his way up towards very strong political power. So we can see that. We can see Frankenstein's monster as being things like fear of new scientific discoveries, fear of children, almost. You can create children, but you can't control them. Can you live up to your responsibilities as a parent? These kinds of things. And here is another quote. We can see monsters as untamed forces that threaten orderly human society, that cross the boundaries that are in place to ensure order, dangerous and threatening others. And this concept of other is quite often used in literature, certain kind of depiction, a common complaint of certain kinds of literature is that particular groups of people are portrayed as being other, which puts them in this category of things that are dangerous, things that are strange and not quite like real people. The monster is used in different ways to deal with these forces, sometimes suggesting that their otherness can be embraced, sometimes that it can be defeated. So in Dracula can be destroyed. This alien influence can be defeated. But the example has just gone clear out of my mind. In some cases, they can be changed, they can be tamed, they can be made to fit into society, or society can adapt in small ways. And that's with more conservative authors. If the authors are actually more liberal in their ideas, in terms of, not in political sense, but in terms of their social and cultural feelings, then sometimes they will offer monsters that can be accepted more into society, and the idea that society might change to give them a place, to make them fit, and they're no longer a threat because they can be part of the social pattern. In weird fiction, monsters are very often used, not necessarily monsters, sometimes strange things, but monsters is a common one, to create and explore these feelings of otherness. And it may be the protagonists are exposed to something threatening and strange, and it's how they feel about it. It may be that they become something threatening and strange. It may be both. Or it can be used, as it is in more horror kinds of literature, to explore fear in a safe way. And that's a way that people often want to enjoy horror literature. So, for example, in The Shadow Over Innsmouth, H.P. Lovecraft, the people of Innsmouth turn out to be monstrous. They are not really human. They are explicitly not human. But we later find out that the protagonist is connected to those people. And that is an exploration of the idea, firstly, the idea of the threat posed by things that are completely strange and novel to you, and your sense of identity, but also this idea that how do you process finding out that you might be like them? That maybe they're not so strange after all. Maybe you're related, maybe you're physically related, maybe you're intellectually related. Maybe, so you could say, for example, sometimes things about young people will portray this idea of the gulf between younger people's behaviour and understanding and older generations. But as people get older, they may find, oh, actually, I'm more like that. I've started to see that point of view. I've started to understand why people behave in that way, why they're thinking that way. In Lovecraft's case, he quite often wanted to explore the ideas of inheritance, and this is partly because for most of his life, he believed that his parents had gone insane through a hereditary illness. That wasn't true. It was a different kind of illness, but he was misled about what was the problem. But so he always had this fear of things passed down in the family that could change you fundamentally from the person you thought you were into something else. You could lose big elements of yourself. And sometimes they used to explore sometimes more problematic things like racial issues. So it can give some insight into what authors specifically are afraid of or the kinds of feelings they're interested in, as I said. The known against the unknown, the rational against the irrational, culture against nature. So here are some ways in which those ideas have inspired people. So I said Lovecraft, this idea of hereditary curses. There are several stories where people learn things about their family, about their ancestors, that either destroy their sense of identity or lead to them changing or indeed dying. There's a lot of Lovecraft stories with fear of the sea because he personally had this terror. He had nightmares about the sea, and he will use a lot of fish and sea life imagery. This is partly why Cthulhu is like an octopus. These cold, slimy feelings is because he personally had a horror of them. Guy de Maupassant was interested in exploring madness and mental conditions and mental feelings. And this is partly because his sanity was unfortunately not very good towards the end of his life. In a very different way, Robert E. Howard, Conan, again, uses these other creatures, the creatures that don't obey the normal laws of time and space and biology, because it's a contrast and it demonstrates because his heroes can overcome even these very inhuman things that are strange and that make people feel terrified and like they don't understand the world anymore, that just emphasizes how awesome they are. Conan is amazing because he can face down these creatures, he can survive these apparently impossible encounters with inhuman creatures. And as I said, unfortunately, it's also used sometimes to explore themes of racism. And people of different races or different cultures or nationalities are portrayed in monstrous ways, either as being associated with terrible things or as secretly being monsters of some kind. I just heard the bell go, so I'm happy to take any questions, but I don't want to make you all stay here. There will be a part three. So I will be doing a third lecture on more modern forms of weird fiction. Does anyone have any questions, comments, thoughts, corrections for my comments about Bo Song Ling? Anything? No? Okay. if no one has anything to say or ask, then please, feel free to leave. It's okay. Thank you for coming. As I said, I have been recording it, so I will put it up online somewhere. If anyone wants access to that recording, please let me know and I will send you a link.